All right, everyone. I'm really excited to have this conversation today.
Yeah,
because
definitely.
Robert, when I first met you, you weren't in robes.
Correct.
And now you are.
Correct.
And when did I first meet you?
2016. Yeah.
And I just learned today, I didn't even realize you were already an ordained monk by 2016.
Correct.
You just hadn't taken the robes.
Yeah, I was ordained in 2012, and then I had to decide, what am I going to do now that I'm ordained? Like, run a temple, like, do a, you know, have a class, take on students. And it was shortly after 2016, like, I really started thinking about how to apply Buddhism to animal rights.
Yeah.
And then I took the robe vows for specifically the animals.
That's right. I do remember you telling me.
Yeah. So I only really wear robes if I'm at the temple or activism, because I'm representing the animals at that moment, and like, that's important to me.
Interesting. I didn't know that. That just makes me think every time I see you, you're representing the animals, because I don't think I've seen you out of robes.
Yeah,
2016.
It's and actually, usually always that.
Yeah. I think I remember you telling me you were an ordained monk in 2016, and I think part of me thought, that can't be true. So I actually think the robes make a big difference, because once you took robes on,
right,
I started realizing, okay, this is a serious thing. And actually, I mean, I think we had some initial conversations where I was telling you about my journey of Buddhism. And because I still don't consider myself like a learned Buddhist. I'm not some master, but I've tried to pick up some simple lessons. And part of the reason I wanted to have this conversation is because I think there are some, you don't have to be a monk to learn some really important things in Buddhism.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
But it doesn't hurt to be a monk.
Right? It just means my training is more formalized. Sure. That's all.
But what made you decide to start wearing the robes?
It was shortly, like I said, shortly after the 2016 forum, and then I went to the 2017 forum. And I just like how, you know, I hear these talks about like, how can I as an individual be the most impactful for animals? What skill sets do I bring to the table? And you know, I just had this deep connection with non-human animals and how they relate spiritually, how they relate to Buddhism. Yeah. And so I thought, you know, that's, you know, I wanted to take my commitment to them very seriously. And I found that, like, that's, you know, taking the robe vows for them was the best way I could do that personally.
Yeah. And what I found is when we make those commitments, especially pursuant to these ancient traditions that make us so connected to not just the animals of today, but the animals through all of history.
Mm.
That's one of the deepest and most powerful insights to me about Buddhism, that some of the mantras you recite are mantras that literally have been said by people for thousands of years.
Yeah.
In contexts where they're stressed or anxious or facing some conflict or violence. And there's something really powerful about that, just knowing, damn, like, people have been saying exactly these words, you know, may all animals be safe, happy, and free. Mm-hmm. Or may all sentient beings, I should say, be safe, happy, and free. People have been repeating exactly these words for thousands of years.
Yes.
And it's created the same meaning for them. I don't know. How did you become Buddhist originally? And then I do want to jump into the substance of what Buddhism is.
Yeah, for
sure. We can talk about our lives and how we became Buddhist.
Like,
but we should tell people what Buddhism actually is at some point. But how did you become Buddhist?
Yeah, so I'm...
Robert Franklin doesn't sound like Buddhist name.
There you go, yeah. My name has since then been legally changed to...
Oh, I didn't know that.
Represent my grandparents who are... were first generation Japanese. They came over here, and there's no lineage family name to carry on, because my great uncle actually was committed suicide in the internment camps. So he would have been the one who carried on the family name, and that always had bothered my grandparents a lot.
So these are the concentration camps in California, right?
No, in Texas, actually.
In Texas.
Yeah.
So was he shipped to Texas from California?
No, he was in Texas.
Wow. And they sent him to an internment camp.
Yeah. And so it was too much for him. He ended up committing suicide. Yeah. And so right before my great-grandmother passed away, I told her, like, I'm going to take on your name.
Wow.
Because I wanted to...
Remember
continue
that.
On.
Yeah.
So, so now I'm Yamada.
Yamada, that's right. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So Buddhism doesn't run in the family, though.
That makes sense. I mean, I've seen Robert Yamada, too, and I didn't realize you had legally changed it to Robert Yamada.
Yeah.
Wow.
But yeah, I was converted to Buddhism. My family was Christian, but very, very open-minded. My mother was extremely open-minded. And she saw it as, like, part of my heritage to, like, embrace Buddhism, so she was very supportive of that.
Yeah. Wow. Was there some catalyst? Was there something in your life that triggered the desire to find this ancient tradition?
You know, I since I could remember, like, when, like, folks would ask, like, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I was like, I just want to serve other people, other beings. I just want to be of service to the folks in a meaningful, spiritual way. Like, that was literally my thoughts when I was 6 years old.
Wow.
And so, like, I got really into church, and I got really into, like, some other religions. I just kind of, like, wanted to research, like, what's the best, what do I connect to, and how can I help other beings?
Yeah, wow.
So that just drew me into Buddhism.
So you're like a Buddhist at six.
Probably, yeah.
Because that's a huge part of the mentality of Buddhism, that you serve yourself by service to others.
Absolutely.
That we're all connected. And when you serve others, you are serving yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
So there are three specific things that I wanted to talk to you about that I think have been really important for me. And that is ahimsa, anatta, and then just presence / meditation, mindfulness.
Yeah.
And I don't think they have... I don't think I've named those in any particular order of importance. If anything, I actually think the middle concept to me is probably the most important. But I'd say probably the last of those, mindfulness, is something everybody has heard of. Has everyone heard of mindfulness? Probably. Who meditates here? Raise your hands. So about half the people
almost
meditate?
Half. Yeah.
Okay. So tell us what mindfulness means to you as a monk and a Buddhist.
Yeah. Mindfulness, I think, is just like being able to, like, put yourself in the moment during, like, stressful situations. I think mindfulness is, like, a tool that we use to, like, encounter and embrace the world around us. And, you know, I don't think that we should be spending all of our time being mindful, because that also means that, like, we need, like, time to recuperate, which means maybe being absent-minded at sometimes. And then we also need to be, like, thinking deeply about our future and, like, what that might be. And that's not mindfulness. I believe, like, mindfulness is being in that moment. And so this practice can be done, like, anytime and anywhere. Mindfulness is, you know, when you're doing dishes. Mindfulness is when you're sitting down doing meditation. Mindfulness could be when you're having to interact with a police officer and you need to be in the present moment so that you don't get hurt.
Yeah. I think one of the things that I learned about mindfulness from the literature on influence and charisma is it turns out mindfulness is actually incredibly influential too. It makes you a more powerful person in the following way. When most people interact with other human beings, they can tell the people around them are not fully present, because there's some internal dialogue that's preventing you from really connecting with the person and observing them, understanding, empathizing with what they are feeling. Because we're so distracted by our internal dialogue. We're worried about what people think about us. Or, you know, we're worried about... I was just talking to Belinda about the fact that she's... Sorry, put you on the spot. She's talking to Belinda about how she's got this really important job problem and she can't stop thinking about it. And so you're trying to talk to someone. Probably all of us have had this experience of both talking to someone and not being there because you're thinking about something else, and also talking to someone who is not there. Right? And both of those are incredibly frustrating experiences. And interestingly, they also make you much less influential. If you cannot be mindful, if you cannot just be present and look at someone in the eyes and make them feel like I'm here with you. I'm not just here adjacent to you in my own little world, but we're here together in a shared space with shared feelings, understandings, and real communication, then people don't like you very much. And if they don't like you, they're not likely to be persuaded by you.
Right.
So it turns out being present, like meditating, makes you more powerful. Mm. Has that been your experience? That's from my experience.
I think, like, it's...
I'm not saying it's a reason to do it.
You're right.
I became a Buddhist to become powerful. would be an ironic contradiction in Buddhism. But
yeah, I think
I don't mean powerful in the sense, like, exerting yourself over others, but I mean powerful in the sense that, like, just having a positive presence in the world.
Yeah. It's a side effect that, like, could be beneficial to be able to have that ability. I think, like, being mindful, though, is also, like, just about compassion for all beings. Yeah. And so, like, that's the should probably be the motivation behind being mindful, is like compassion for other beings, and that, like, being mindful will help you encounter conflict and problems in a much more open-hearted way.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think that's why I think mindful is important to me personally.
This is why we need a monk rather than me talking about Buddhism, because I'm like talking about, hey, this is what the impact will be, and it's like. Sometimes you should do things because they're just intrinsically good.
Right, that's the foundation of Buddhism.
In fact, really all times you should do things because they're intrinsically good. So the mindfulness is obviously all the rage and everyone talks about it. And you have, we live next to Twitter, or I live next to Twitter, and Jack Dorsey, the former CEO of Twitter, is all about mindfulness, and all the big tech CEOs are all like, oh, meditate, be mindful. But I actually think for me, the more fundamental concept in understanding mindfulness was another concept called anatta, which I'm sure you're at least somewhat familiar with, because I know different traditions emphasize different concepts in Buddhism. Right. And I don't even know which traditions really focus on this concept. Has anyone heard of anatta before? Like, I'm sure everyone's heard of ahimsa. So everyone's heard of mindfulness. Everyone's heard about ahimsa. And I told you, for me, anatta has been the most important influencing factor. Who has heard of anatta here? Anybody? Yeah. Do you know, how do you define it? What you've heard about it? Can't define it? Okay. So when I first read about it, and I want to get your take on this too, because I'm very interested in what you learned about anatta from a formal training perspective. I've only like read Wikipedia pages. And I have read some ancient Buddhist texts too, like some ancient scrolls from China and places like that about anatta. But it's usually interpreted as the denial of self, or the self as a fiction, that they're, you know, what we perceive as our own subjective consciousness is a delusion. And one of the great things about Buddhism is it's a very reflective form of spirituality, and you can kind of make of it what you ascertain from your own reflections. And so I read this initially, and these are all English translations, so I don't really understand what the original people wrote about this in Sanskrit or Chinese meant, or Japanese, you know, various languages from hundreds or thousands of years ago. But the English translation never felt great to me because it was a denial. It felt like this, you're resisting something. And if you have to resist, if you have to deny the self, that means the self is there in some important way. And part of the reason this is an important concept is, for me, at least when I read about anatta originally, it was part of the reason Buddhists were so detached from the world. You know, you've probably heard Buddhists are detached from their material possessions. And part of what I was reading 10 years ago when I first was exposed to this concept, maybe 15 years ago, was the reason Buddhists can be so detached is because they realize their self is a fiction. So if my self is a fiction, then why would I care about money or wealth or power or status? Because all these thoughts and emotions are delusions anyways. And that sounded just frankly not consistent with reality in a lot of ways to me, because we all have a self in some sense, and we all know these desires feel very real. Like, you know, you're poor and you're living on the street, money matters so I can get a house. Or, you know, for me, you're a total dork and everyone hates you. And when you're growing up and you're Chinese and people are racist to you, and you would kind of like social status. And it's like, it's fine and good to say, oh, don't worry, kid, people are beating you up, but yourself is a fiction, so don't worry about those scars on your face. It's like, for that kid who's getting beaten up, it's real. And so, but like, when I reflected on it, what I realized, for me at least, is that it doesn't really mean the denial of self. It's rather the connection to all the other selves. That each of us, each of our subjectivities, and I read more about it, and I realized this is kind of what they're really getting at. It's not so much that our own consciousness isn't real. It's more that our consciousness is just part of this ocean of consciousness out there. And what you're feeling, what I'm feeling, what Dean's feeling, what the cat is feeling, what the rat is feeling, what the turkey is feeling. These feelings are all part of the same sea of consciousness. I don't even literally mean in some physical way. I just mean that the substrates, the mechanism, the what consciousness is not just me. Like, and the way I've described it before is, and then I want to get your thoughts on this, is anatta basically represents the idea that each of our perspectives is like a little pinhole in the universe. Imagine you're walking around in the universe and everything was complete darkness, except a tiny little pinhole. And I could see just through this tiny little pinhole. And, you know, I might think that, oh, that must mean the pinhole is the world. But in fact, if you were looking at the world through a tiny little pinhole and you couldn't see anything else, you'd see such a small part of the actual universe. And you might be deluded into thinking this is the universe, but it really is just a tiny little pinhole. And anatta is recognizing, no, there's actually a broader universe out there. It's lighting up all the rest of that darkness and realizing there's an entire beautiful universe out there beyond this little pinhole. And that pinhole is just our subjectivity. I don't know. But is that, tell me what you think about anatta and like what it means to you.
Yeah, I think that's a really beautiful sentiment. Like, it sounds really pretty when you say it.
Not that the other shoe's going to drop.
No, here's what's wrong
about it.
No, I don't think, actually, there's not a whole lot wrong without that. Like, this is a very...
Thank God, because I didn't study very formally at all. I just read Wikipedia.
This is, like, a very rooted idea, too, in, like, Zen Buddhism, which is, like, where my formal training came from. And the way I interpret it is that, like, yeah, correct. Like, there is no self because we are all interconnected. Because even my very, like, thought of happiness, like, if I just think happy, like, you've been in situations where you go into a room and somebody just seems to be glowing happy. They're not doing anything. They're not saying anything. But that happiness somehow is contagious.
Yeah.
And somehow you can feel that.
Yeah.
And so this is, like, just the subtle ways, like, we are all connected.
Yeah.
Right? And, like, we are, by saying that there is no self, it just simply means that, like if there is infinite amount of beings, mm-hmm. like, the self is probably, like you said, like, that's the pinhole that you're looking through. Mm-hmm. Like, when you think about self, I see it as, like, looking through, like wanting to see who you are, looking through a pinhole into a mirror that's, like, right here.
Yeah.
There's nothing. You're not even comprehending anything at all at this level.
Yeah.
Right? So we need to, like, let go, like, oh, there's no mirror, there is no self.
Yeah.
Right? And then, we can remove this mirror in front of us and start to realize, oh, this is a much broader, bigger world out there that, like, is actually me. Like, when I look down at a chicken, like, I see me.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Like, there. And absolutely. So when they suffer, like, I suffer tremendously. And when they're happy and they're full and they're eating, like, I feel full and I feel complete.
Yeah.
And so idea of, like, selflessness is actually the idea of, like, interconnectedness.
Yeah.
So I prefer, like, I often talk about interconnectedness rather than selflessness, because selflessness sounds, or non-self sounds, like like you said, the denial of self. That is actually the translation, or the best known translation, is denial of self. And it just kind of, like, feels really bleak, like, and it's not really what they were trying to get at.
I like the concept of the embracing of other selves.
Mm.
Not denying yourself, but recognizing that we're all connected.
Yeah.
You know, like this concept of inner being that Thich Nhat Hanh is most famous for. Mm-hmm. And there's something really beautiful about it. And interestingly, I don't know if anyone's had an experience with psilocybin. I have not, unfortunately. Someday I will. After animal liberation, I've committed to taking psilocybin because I'm sober. I want to stay sober because facing all these charges, it's probably good for me to say I'm sober, and because everybody already thinks I'm like a hippie druggy type, so better for me to say at least some things that contradict that narrative. But I've heard when you take psilocybin, you get that same feeling, this deep feeling of connectedness. Has anyone taken psilocybin had that feeling before? Is that what happens?
It depends. But I would say yes.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Meditate more.
Yeah. Yeah, you can get this way from meditation, too.
Yeah.
Like, if you meditate seriously and sometimes long enough, you get into these weird states where the boundaries between you and other beings, and even, like, the world, it just feels, you get into this weird kind of dreamlike state where even the physicality of your body feels like it's no longer a limit.
Yeah.
You know, like, I don't know, it's pretty powerful.
Yeah, for sure.
It's a very powerful feeling. And I think importantly, and I'm going to, again, be the non-Buddhist monk, and think about the strategic reasons to try and get into this state. I think this concept of anatta and this feeling of interconnectedness is really important for activism. Because I think one of the ways you change people is by making people feel like we're all connected, including the animals. Mm. And just like happiness is a contagious state, I actually feel like interconnectedness is too.
Right.
When you find someone who's like one of these beings, including animals. This is one of the beautiful things about dogs, for example. Dogs are connected to all of us, at least a lot of times when they're well treated, when they feel safe, when they're not traumatized. They have this connectedness that we lack. They have this ability to bring people together. Go to a dog park and watch the dogs interact.
Mm-hmm.
And it's such a beautiful, happy, and I'm not saying there aren't conflicts, there are,
because
every dog is a limited consciousness too. They don't understand the other dog's feelings as well as maybe they should sometimes. But there's still this connectedness from being around animals that we often don't get around human beings.
Yeah, I think this is why it's important that, like, we do practice mindfulness, because that is, like, what mindfulness is like the recognition of selflessness, or the recognition of interconnectedness.
Yeah.
Like, when we can be mindful, like, we don't even need meditation if we can just like be in this mindful state and just connect to people. So in a way, it's like we don't need to like be Buddhist to connect activism.
Yeah, we don't.
Like what we do need is probably compassion, and what we do need is an idea of togetherness and this like mindfulness practice. It's just from, I mean, we say mindfulness word, and like the CEOs all get really super happy because they want, you know, their workers to do better.
Yeah.
But like, I'd rather just say like compassion, like just be present for each other in those moments. That's all it is.
Yeah, that's right. Because mindfulness is about empathy and compassion. Mm. Ultimately, it's about being present for the people around you rather than lost in some other resentment. Right. Or, so I'll share one tip about Ananda that has been extraordinarily helpful for me. And it's interesting because there's a leadership trainer named Olivia Fox in the Bay Area, who's trained some of the big CEOs in the Bay Area, who's independently come to the same conclusion from just studying the research on effective leadership and influence. And that is, especially when you're in difficult and tense situations, imagining you're an observer of your life and observing everybody, like all parties, including people who are your adversaries, your quote unquote adversaries. So I'll often, because I was a social scientist at one point in my life, and this actually happened at trial. There were times when, you know, this prosecutor's objecting to me, doing all these kind of nasty things, asserting ridiculous things about us that, oh, they're just here to raise money, or they have a political cause. They don't, they're not here to help animals. Don't believe anything they're saying. And they're interrupting me left and right. And just what Olivia Fox and what I've learned from Buddhism is, if you just imagine you're an anthropologist studying these funny creatures, you know, or an ethologist, you know, like Jane Goodall, watching these beautiful tribes of chimps, often doing strange things and sometimes even hurtful things. Like, she watched chimps do horrific things to each other sometimes. Mm-hmm. But the fact that she was observing and not a part of it gave her, like, both a detachment and an attachment.
Mm-hmm.
Right? There was a detachment in the sense that she wasn't lost in one individual conflict. It wasn't like when two chimps fought, that was the end of my world.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also an attachment because she would see the chimps fighting and see how it related to all the other chimps in the tribe, in the group, you know, and be able to see that bigger picture. And so when you're in tough situations, I think one of the most important things is really just step out of it for a moment and just imagine you're like an anthropologist studying yourself. Or even that, if you're a religious or spiritual person, imagine you're God. This is one of the powerful things about God. This, and this is why AA works too, from what I understand, because they have this principle in AA that I think, like, understanding there's a higher power and that, you know, you don't have control. Like, it's almost like that, when you step outside of yourself and you're just imagining yourself just observing the situation rather than trying to exert control over it, it actually gives you a lot of peace. So it's really powerful. Okay, I want to move on to one last concept and then we'll open things up. And that is, I think, the one that is most famous, which is ahimsa. And has everyone heard about ahimsa? Everybody? Has anyone not heard about ahimsa? Does everyone know what ahimsa means, the translation? What does ahimsa mean? Actually, for you, Robert.
Oh, yeah, that's probably a bad question for me. My my Sanskrit is like really bad, and it kind of like, I'd have to immediately translate it to like Japanese and try to remember what that all is all about. But like mostly like loving kindness and a particular type of love, right? Like,
like even for your adversaries, right?
Oh, absolutely.
This is deep nonviolence, not just. Not just superficial, I don't punch people.
Right. Like, if you have a deep affinity for turkeys like I do, like, and then I try to imagine, like, the folks that are hurting turkeys as turkeys themselves. Mm-hmm. And like you said, and then remove yourself from it and kind of see, like, how do I now feel about the situation?
Yeah.
Like, I am just torn apart and sad for both individuals now. And now I don't have, like, a resentment for one or the other or anger towards one or the other. I just have a lot of compassion and loving kindness for all of them.
Yeah. Yeah, I think in love and kindness is beautiful, but I think it's also so widely misunderstood in activism context, because people think of love and kindness as this almost this weakness. It's like, oh, you're one of those people who just sits around and in a drum circle and chants kumbaya all day. And what ahimsa really means, and like, it's very interesting. I went and read some very ancient Chinese text about ahimsa and what it meant for the Chinese, like 1,500 years ago or however long ago. I don't remember what it was, but it was like over 1,000 years ago. And it was basically an exhortation to do open rescues.
Yes.
Like, from 1,500 years ago. And there's, in fact, this entire concept that I sort of reclaimed and came in touch with called function in Chinese, which is also called life release. And unfortunately, it's practiced here, even in San Francisco, in a way that's not so healthy. Because like many traditions, it's kind of been corrupted. But the idea behind it is, and there's even an ancient Chinese Buddhist text that says this literally, when you see an animal who's facing slaughter, nonviolence means you have the duty to intervene. Not just that you have the right to, but to live a good life, to be a responsible citizen of the world, you have a duty. You actually have to step in between the person who's going to hurt the animal and the animal themselves. And this is any animal, not just, it says all animals, not just human beings. You have a duty to step in and let them hurt you instead. And I was like, wow. And so how this practice has unfortunately materialized in places like San Francisco, there's still to this day, I think there are at least thousands, maybe tens of thousands of animals in San Francisco every year where Chinese Buddhists will, and I don't mean to shit on Chinese Buddhists because I'm a Chinese Buddhist for one, but secondly, there are things they understand that I don't about Buddhism. But this is one thing I feel like I do understand, they don't. They will literally just buy animals from slaughterhouses and then release them in the wild. Like, and apparently the best estimate, I think, is 600 million animals across the world are released primarily by Chinese Buddhists because of these ancient traditions. They just go to slaughterhouses. It's most often aquatic animals. And it's one of the worst things is they'll sometimes like buy saltwater animals and drop them in a stream. Like, so there's not a lot of thought put into it because it's just become so bureaucratic. It's and it's about, and it's partly because it's not even about true empathy with the other consciousness. It's just about this ritual you engage in to be a good Buddhist and to get karma. I don't know. So
I'm glad you brought that up. Like, it's
it's
like,
bad.
Like, tradition sometimes like falls away and distorted and doesn't get to the main point. But like, I'm really like happy to see folks like remember like, Misa, loving kindness. Like, that doesn't mean like just stand away and say like, I love everybody here. And everything's going to be okay. Because it's not going to be okay unless you intervene, unless you take action. You know, the Zen is teachers are famous for saying like, you know, sitting on a meditation pillow and meditating is like useless until you get off that pillow and do something with that mindfulness, do something with that meditative ability. Like, this is like so important. And like, life release has just like not been exactly done incorrectly and translated correctly. Like, we have to think about like, how do we intervene? Like, how? What is like skillful means is a concept in Tibetan Buddhism. So that's really important when we start thinking about like, how can we best help other beings? But intervening is super important. I remember at the sanctuary, often I'm out there chasing coyotes away from the wild turkeys.
Wait, literally you are running
literally
around?
I'm literally running around. Often in my robes, running trying to chase away the wild coyotes. And this is actually very controversial, and I've talked to a lot of folks about this. Like, if you see something where you have the ability to intervene with a natural predator from taking away their natural food, right? Like, they need those turkeys to eat and to survive. They maybe try to capture this turkey to feed some of their babies. And I intervene anyway. This is very controversial. From a Buddhist standpoint, like, we are only given the moment, and we have to like act in that moment and do what we can do to like save who we can save. I'm not always there all the time. The turkeys are in other parts of the land that I can't intervene, and there's nothing I can do. But when I have the ability to intervene, like, as a Buddhist idea, like, we must intervene. So when we see a turkey at the slaughterhouse and we have the ability to take them out, like, we now have a responsibility. A very strong spiritual religious responsibility to take them out. Regardless of, you know, the maybe the, you know, people's wages will be affected. You know, there's a lot of things that happen down the road that could be considered negative, but like, in the moment, like, that's part of being in that moment, practicing all of these things, like, we must do something, we must intervene.
It's a very, very deontological approach. Eric will be happy. Eric's sitting here. Matthew is not happy. He's like, God damn it, these Buddhists with their virtue ethics. No, I'm kidding. So I think we should open things up. So if anyone has any thoughts, comments, criticisms, or questions, if you could just hop into that chair and speak into that mic, that would be awesome. But does anyone have any thoughts they want to add? Like, does anyone else identify as Buddhist? Really, just me and Robert? Okay. Was anyone have any questions or thoughts? Allie, jump to the mic.
I've been interested in Eastern religions because of their focus on animal rights and nonviolence towards animals. So I don't necessarily like call myself any particular title, but I have studied Jainism in India for about 5 weeks in 2016 because of
interest.
Yeah.
You went to India. Wow.
International School for Jain Studies.
That's amazing.
Because of, everything just lined up for me where someone was talking about Ahimsa and I resonated a lot with that. And I had a prior teacher like reach out to me saying that I should learn about this. And then from another area of my life, I was given the opportunity by a vegan world religions teacher at my university. So I was getting a lot of information about Ahimsa from different areas of my life. So I felt like it was kind of meant to happen. And so I think, Jainism and Buddhism, I'm thinking about like some of the principles, like in they've been helpful for me in considering like my anxiety and how I felt about internal suffering as well as like external suffering in the world, and the idea of like the bodhisattva and just this feeling like I want to keep coming back if there is reincarnation, at least. Like, not, I don't really have any like firm beliefs, but just this idea of continuously showing up for those that are suffering and being there to try to alleviate that as a responsibility. So I think from the mental health perspective and also from the sort of altruistic and duty to like really alleviate suffering, kind of those have been what has like brought me to learn about Buddhism and different forms of Buddhism and Jainism specifically. And I've I've also benefited from meditation, but I'm still kind of figuring out how to incorporate a more daily practice, but I feel like I've benefited a lot from the principles and how it's helped me like make sense of my purpose.
Yeah. And I think there's something powerful about compassion for others that makes you have more compassion for yourself too. Than when, because I blogged about this today, but one of the interesting things about animal rescue, for example, is that no matter how bad you're feeling, after you rescue an animal, you start feeling a lot fucking better. Like, you really do. Doesn't matter. I mean, I've blogged about this. Like, I was on the brink of, I mean, sorry if this is triggering anyone. I'm going to talk about self-harm. So, sorry. So, anyone on the podcast, if you need to shut it off. But, you know, in 2007, when I first walked into a slaughterhouse, I was on the brink of killing myself. And then I walked into a slaughterhouse, and I didn't even successfully. I just tried to save an animal. And it just completely transformed my perspective with my own suffering. Like, I just realized that, well, I realized two things. One is I have the power to help others, but I also realized I have the power to help myself, you know, because it was, it just became very apparent to me that there are these incredibly, profoundly vulnerable beings who are literally just a few feet away from us. And one of the hard things about being a Buddhist and feeling like we have an obligation to intervene is we're standing here in San Francisco. 5-10 minutes away, there are live animal markets where animals are being slaughtered by the hundreds, if not the thousands. You know, we've been there.
Yeah.
Robert and I have both been there. And you can walk by them and see the animals screaming in their cages. And we've taken a few out over the years. But the idea that you have a duty is, in some ways, can feel terrifying, right? Because it feels like, damn, every time I walk by and I'm not just jumping in there, blocking the slaughter blade from cutting a chicken's throat, I'm not living up to my responsibility. But I think the way you overcome that is, again, realizing that it's not just my responsibility, it's our responsibility. It's a systemic issue. And realizing that, yes, maybe my subjectivity in this vessel of consciousness, my body, is not doing everything it can at all times. But again, my body is part of a broader consciousness. And it's really all of us need to cure ourselves of this plague, which it is, this plague of suffering and violence. So, anyways.
Yeah, I think that's such an interesting concept. Like, I think rescue is like a tool that we use to like help our practice, our own like Buddhist practice. But like living being a Buddhist like means like connecting to all beings all the time and trying to like change the entire system so that these things don't continue to happen. Yeah. And I think that's like Like, that's what we're trying to get to. Like, that's what we aspire to. Rescue is, like you said, like, makes us feel a little bit better and gives us different insight, but isn't, like, the way to achieve liberation. Is just to rescue all beings. To do that, like, we need to get everybody to take that responsibility. It is our responsibility.
Yeah, I agree with that 100%. I just released a podcast with Gene Bauer about this, and he says the same thing. You can't rescue your way to liberation.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing I'd push back on is I feel very strongly that rescue is one of the ways politically we reach liberation for all beings. Because I think the storylines and the emotional power of rescue, if we do it well, you know, and we do it with nonviolence and we have mass movements participate and get people plugged into it, it has huge symbolic power beyond just the two sentient beings or, you know, the many sentient beings involved in any discrete rescue. Any other questions or comments? Anyone else have a thought? Any criticisms? Anyone think Buddhism is nonsense in the spirit of disagreement? Max, you're smiling. Say it in the mic.
I would say out of all religions I know, Buddhism makes the most sense.
Oh, I thought you were going to say something critical. But then again, that doesn't sound like it's a very high bar, because the way you're saying out of all the religions I know, Buddhism makes the most sense. What are you? Are you an atheist?
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, technically, I'm an atheist too. So you can be an atheist Buddhist, for the record.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And
well, I think the philosophy of Buddhism makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, honestly, it's Buddhism, it's kind of just moral philosophy as a religion in many ways. You know, because a lot of the principles of utilitarianism, for example, and even, I mean, deontology too, like, it really is just turning thinking about morality into a religion. Because I think that's what Buddhists are sort of responsible for. It's weird because most religions have some weird mythology to them, and there is some mythology to Buddhism too, but it's not strong. It's not deep. Mm. It's a lot of it is about your own internal practice of like reflection and thought. So, Kyle, do you have Buddhism in your family's history? Yeah, go to the mic. Sorry to put you on the spot, but I feel like a lot of us brothers and sisters in the Chinese tradition. I mean, we do. Like a lot of us do have these, and I think we've lost it. You know, a lot of it.
I mean, I say that of myself. I feel like I'm not exactly close with my Asian Buddhist, whatever you call it, like tradition or whatever. But I wouldn't say my parents are either. Like, my mom is Catholic, and my dad is at best like the holiday Christian version of a Buddhist, as in like he's not really a practicing one. But I mean, we have, you know, that the weird like ancestor shrine that you have at home with the with the like plug-in candles and stuff.
That's great.
Yeah, so we have that, and I guess occasionally, I mean by like very occasionally, like once a year or something, we go to the cemetery to honor our ancestors or whatever. But I don't think, besides in terms of like, I guess that's more of a Confucianism thing of, you know, like mindset or like just living your life. I don't think my family is very religious or more Buddhist at all.
Interesting. Is your dad vegetarian?
Hell no.
No? Interesting. No. Yeah, I feel like Chinese Buddhism, at least from what I've seen, approaches animal suffering probably in the most strongly animal rights way. And certainly if you go to like the Chinese Buddhist temples in the Bay Area, for the most part, I think they're vegan now, which is pretty cool. But I also think your dad's not alone. A lot of the temples may be vegan, but the, I don't even know what you call them. Do you call them parishioners? What's the right term?
That's probably the closest.
Parishioner? Okay. Yes, that tells you how little I know about these temples, because I've been to them, but I'm not like a regular member. I'd like to become a member of a temple, but the parishioners, the participants themselves, they see the monks, like they'll see someone like Robert and say like, oh, that's who we should be. But then they go back and don't do it themselves, right? It's like, oh yeah. And they almost, it's almost this weird thing where they donate to the temple and they think, oh, the monks are vegetarians, so I don't have to be, you know? Yeah. There's like a lot of that going on, which is weird because it's like, wait, but you're kind of conceding that this is the way we should live and then we're not doing it ourselves. We're just kind of projecting all of our aspirations onto the monks, which is, I don't know. I think that's weird. Are you still connected in those traditions? Like, do you feel they're emotionally powerful to you?
I mean, I guess I've never really looked into it that much, but I did go through, you know, the whole teenage anti-religion, angsty phase and all that. But that was more because, I guess, my mom tried to raise me as Catholic. Like, I think I'm baptized or something, but I should know if I'm not or not. But
Is your mom Chinese too?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, my mom is Chinese, but
I ask that because I don't know that many Chinese Catholics. Are there a lot of them? I don't know. Maybe there are.
Or I don't know if it makes a difference, but my mom is from Hong Kong, so like, you know, the whole British thing, and like she speaks like, you know, English and not like, you know, Chinese. So it's like I'll speak English to them and all that. And but I would say my dad, being Buddhist, has always had a very hands-off approach to religion. Like, he just doesn't really care, and I guess that kind of goes into the whole atheism and Buddhism coexisting in one sphere kind of thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, like I said, I don't know too much about any religion to make a strong opinion on that.
Yeah, one of the weirdest things about Buddhism for me, and it's just to a certain extent true of Hinduism too, is not only does it lack like a mythology, which almost every religion has a mythology, even Hinduism has a, and Buddhism is in some ways, in fact, it's kind of a descendant of Hinduism in some, in very deep and historical ways. But most religions have some story, and Buddhism has some stories, and there are certainly some stories my parents would tell me, but not really, like, it's not like the Bible, or it's not like Hinduism and Shiva and Vishnu and all these, like, deity figures. It's just, you have this wise master just thought about stuff, Buddha, and he reached enlightenment just from thinking about things. It's like, that's your aspiration, just be someone who thinks about stuff and gets the answers right because you think about stuff and you have right thinking, you know? Mm. But the other way that Buddhism is pretty interesting, for me at least, is it's not particularly evangelical, and it's surprising to me it became one of the world's dominant religions, because I don't know really that many historical episodes where Buddhism has ever been the sort of religion that says you have to go out and spread it to other people.
Yeah.
It's just kind of like, it has benefits for us and our community, so it just naturally draws people into it.
Yeah, that's correct.
So, anyways, all right, cool. Any last thoughts? Otherwise, you should get back to food and fun. All right, well, thank you so much, Robert. Do you have any final thoughts that you'd like to share? Any tidbits of wisdom about Buddhism that you think could help?
Yeah, I think, you know, I've been wanting to say this, is that, like, there's a story of, in Chinese Buddhism about Wen Damo, the person who is responsible for bringing Buddhism from India to China. Hmm. And because he was this, like, well-known master, the emperor sought him out to ask him about Buddhism, and it said, like, he has himself, the emperor, had become a devout follower of Buddhism, had opened all these temples, have given all this money to all of these temples and created big shrines to the Buddha, and said, you know, like how much karma do I get from all this? Bodhidharma said, like, oh, like, none. Like, you just used it up in the question. Because, like, you obviously are searching for that, and so you gave it back to yourself immediately.
It's like, wah, wah, wah.
you spent all
your fortune.
So it's like, well, what does it mean to be a Buddhist? Like, what does it take? And, like, very simply, the answer was, like, oh, do good things because it's the good thing to do.
Yeah.
And avoid doing bad things because it's a bad thing to do. And then you're a Buddhist.
Huh.
So I, like, walk around and, like, just look at, like, all the people here, like, to me, like, you're all just Buddhists. You're all Buddhists, so that's fine. Because you...
you didn't know it, but you're already Buddhist.
Yeah, you adhere to that, and that's, like, the most important part. Like, whether or not you believe some guy 2,500 years ago found the way to enlightenment, that doesn't even matter. And, like, he would even say, it doesn't matter either. Like, unless you, like, find your own enlightenment, none of that matters. Right. Yeah. Just do good things because it's the right thing to do, and don't do those bad things because you know they're bad things to do.
Yeah,
that's it.
So don't be that, like, that dumb Chinese emperor 2,000 years ago, whenever it was.
Well, he contributed a lot to the temple.
Yeah, I'm sure he did.
Nice.
So, maybe not entirely. There is room for effective altruists. Don't worry. No, I'm just kidding. For any effective altruists in the world, I apologize for offending you. Go ahead, continue earning to give. All right, that was awesome. Thank you for those wise and beautiful words. Thank you all for joining. And yeah, I'll see you next time. All right, thanks, everybody.